John chapter 2, Gospel of John chapter 2. Had a great study a week ago that Eric presented for us on a faithful woman in the Old Testament. Be doing another study tonight on another faithful sister in Christ from years ago. John chapter 2 is an incident where this woman appears, but she usually doesn't get the much attention in this passage, unfortunately. But says on the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And Jesus also was invited, and his disciples were there at this wedding. And when the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what do I have to do with you? My house is not yet come. My hour is not yet come." And his mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." And now there were 6 stone water pots set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons each. And Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw out some now and take it to the head waiter." And they took it to him. And when the head waiter tasted the water, which had become wine, and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called the bridegroom, and he said to him, "Every man serves the good wine first, and then, and when men have drunk freely, then that which is poorer you have kept the good wine until now. This beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." First, one of the early miracles of Jesus at a wedding in feast in Cana, and really what that story was told principally was just to illustrate the beginning of his signs and how he began to manifest his glory in this particular sign. But unfortunately, that miracle seems to get more attention because he turned water to wine than anything else, and that didn't seem to be a concern of the Lord that he reported that incident. Probably a good explanation for that, but that's not our study tonight. But there is another point in there, the beginning of that, and that is that Jesus' mother appears in that story, and she seems to push him a little bit, and he sort of gently corrects her in response. And I want us to think a little bit this morning, or this evening, about the mother of Jesus. We'll talk about Mary. Theologians have been pretty creative with Mary. Shape said that she's without sin, that she was assumed up into heaven without dying, that she was born a virgin herself, that she's more accessible than Jesus is and his father. They've been pretty creative with Mary over the years, and some churches have therefore given an unhealthy amount of attention to her, even worshiping her. But unfortunately, because of this negative, unhealthy fiction that's been created around her, to counterbalance it, there's a tendency for us to almost give her no attention at all. Maybe almost to ignore. And somehow that is going to take away from some of the negative press that she gets. But I don't think that's the best response. I think God knew that all of this would happen. He knew certainly that there would be false doctrines created about Mary. He would even have known that some would worship Mary, but yet he chose still to put her story in the Bible. And so I think it would be well worth our time to read about her and look at some of the various stages of her life and learn what a godly woman is through... I always start this in the wrong place... what a godly woman is through the life and of faith that she exemplified. So look with me back to Luke chapter 1. I'm going to start there and read this section here where she's introduced. And we're going to begin down in verse 26 and 27. There's several scenes in the Gospels that sort of bring Mary to the forefront, and we're going to look at several of these tonight with the time that we have. The first thing, as she's introduced to us in Luke chapter 1, verse 26 and 27, and she is she's sort of an expectant mother. Look, if you would, there. Luke 1, 26 and 27. It says, now in the sixth month, of the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a city in Galilee called Nazareth to a virgin engaged to a man whose name was Joseph, of the descendants of David, and the virgin's name was Mary. She is a woman who is betrothed to a man named Joseph. She's betrothal, if I understand right, took place shortly after puberty. She may have therefore been a young teenager. She was considered the wife of Joseph already, though they were living apart and would not have had the relationships of a man and a woman yet. So she's a young woman. Her age is uncertain. Mary was a common name. There's a lot of Marys in the New Testament. There's Mary, the mother of Jesus, Mary, the sister of Lazarus and Martha, Mary, the mother of Clopas. She had Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of John Mark. And the reason that name was so popular was it was the equivalent of the word Miriam, the name Miriam in the Old Testament. So that's a very important woman of the Old Testament, and so many were named after her. But it was a common, ordinary name. And that's sort of thrown up in Jesus' face when we get to Mark chapter 6. I don't know if I put that. Mark chapter 6 and verse 3, that when Jesus went back home for a visit to his hometown, some people confronted him. Mark chapter 6. And he was in the synagogue teaching, and people were astonished, and they said in verse 2, where did this man get these things? And where did this wisdom come from? All these miracles he's performing. Verse 3, is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and the brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? Are not his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him, sort of thrown up in his face. This is a carpenter, and the son of a carpenter, and his mother, it's just another Mary, and he's just another Jewish boy. How can he be doing this sort of thing? And so, and not only that, she was from Nazareth. Nazareth was a little city in Galilee. I never thought about this before, but you're supposed to see in Luke chapter 1 a contrast between Gabriel's mission, that is the angel's mission to Jerusalem, the great capital city of Jerusalem, where he went to the temple in the midst of a public worship service where he talks to Zechariah and announces the birth of his coming son, John, with now the second mission of this angel where he goes to this little obscure village in Galilee, where he goes to a young girl less than 15 to announce to her the birth of her son. And she's not anybody special here. And yet, at the same time, she is a woman who found the favor of God. And so in verse 28 and 30, this angel who comes to her, and we're going to go back to Luke again, Luke chapter 1, verse 28 through 30. This angel comes to Mary, and let's see what he says to her. He says, coming in, he says to her, "Hail, favored one, the Lord is with you." But she was greatly troubled at this statement and kept pondering what kind of salutation this might be. And the angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God." She found favor with the Lord. On what basis would this girl have found favor with the Lord? What worldly basis would she have found his favor? Here's a young girl from an obscure village, poor as dirt, we'll learn later. She's common, and yet she is not common. She is favored by God. She's been chosen from among all the women in Palestine to be the one through whom God will bring the Messiah. She's ordinary, but she is exceptional. Application for us that I want you to think about as we go through this lesson tonight and think about her. She will serve as a model for young ladies. If you're looking for a model of a woman who is favored by the Lord, then this woman will serve as a great model for you. Or for a young man who wants to know, what is a godly woman? I haven't married. Wondering what kind of woman does God favor? Mary will serve as the model of a godly woman. And so I want to introduce this lesson with that. But I want us to think about, why would she be favored by God? Why would she? Certainly it was not because she was poor, or because she was common, or because she was from some obscure town. God, I think there's a great lesson there, and that is that God can find great servants in unlikely places. I think that's an excellent lesson. That's not why he favored her. I would suggest to you, the first thing is because she was pure. Let's read verses 31 through 34. It says, "And behold, you will conceive in your womb," the angel said, "and you will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus. And he will be great, and will be called the Son of the Most High. And the Lord God will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and his kingdom will have no end." And Mary said to the angel, "How can this be, since I am a virgin?" Yeah, it had been a great honor. In fact, it may have been the dream of every Jewish girl to find out that she would be the mother of the Messiah. "But," Mary says, "how can this be? Because I'm pure. I'm a virgin." You know, Zechariah had doubts. Back in chapter 1 and verse 18, he had said to the angel, "How can I know this for certain?" When he said that he would receive a child, because he said, "I'm old and my wife is well beyond the age of giving birth to children." But Mary doesn't show doubt. She just shows a little confusion. How is this going to be? It just doesn't make sense. She was clear, though. "I'm a virgin." There was no hesitation in what she said. There was no questionable actions in her life to darken her claim to purity. She never consummated the marriage between her and Joseph, nor anybody else. She'd never been together with another man. Mary was pure, and I would suggest to you that her chaste and her godly behavior, her conduct, earned her a favored place before God. How many girls in our society would be excluded from this opportunity because of that? Mary was a godly woman, and so therefore she becomes a woman who should be imitated. But another thing I would suggest, why she may have been favored by God, and that's because she was engaged to be married. Now, I need to say that a woman can be godly and not be a wife and not be a mother. And a man can be godly and not ever be a father or ever be a husband, just like Paul the Apostle was a godly man and never married. But clearly in the Bible, I think that it was God's intention that man and woman would marry and have children. Genesis 1 and verse 28, He tells Adam and Eve, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill, you know, replenish the earth." And to the elders, whenever in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2 and 4, when he talks about the role of elders and the qualification of elders, you know, they're to have a wife, they're to be married, and they're to have children, even faithful children. And then look in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 14, whenever Paul writes to a young women who are widows, he says, "Therefore I want younger widows to get married and bear children and to keep house and to give the enemy no occasion for reproach." This was what God intended for women. Our society does not respect the career or the occupation of being a mother. I got a little post the other week that Holly sent me that I thought was kind of neat. This woman went to renew her driver's license at the county clerk's office, and she was asked by the woman recorder to state her occupation. And she hesitated, and she was uncertain how to classify herself. And the lady said, "What I mean is," explained the recorder, "do you have a job or are you just a..." And you can fill in the blank. And the lady responded, "Of course I have a job. I'm a mom." And the lady says, "We don't list moms as an occupation. Housewife covers it." And the lady who wrote this said, put this in here, said, "I forgot all about her story until one day I found myself in the same situation, this time at our town hall. And the clerk was obviously a career woman, poised, efficient, and possessed a high-sounding title like town registrar. And she said, "What's your occupation?" And the lady thought about it a minute, and how she was going to respond to this, knowing the way it went for the last lady who had said she was a mom. So she said, "I'm a research associate in the field of child development and human relations." And the clerk sort of paused, and the ballpoint pen froze it in the middle, midair, and looked up as though she had not heard her quite right. So the lady repeated it, the title, more slowly, emphasizing all the significant words. And the lady, after she had wrote that down, she said, "What might I ask exactly? Just what you do in your field?" So very coolly, the lady began to explain to her. She said, "Well, I have a continuing program of research. What mother doesn't in the laboratory and in the field? Normally, I would have said outside and inside. I'm working for my master's, first the Lord and then the whole family, and already I have 4 credits, all daughters. Of course, the job is one of the most demanding in the humanities. Any mother disagree? And I often work 14 hours a day, 24 is more like it. But the job is more challenging than most run-of-the-mill careers, and the rewards are more of a satisfaction rather than just money." And she said there was an increasing note of respect in the clerk's voice as she completed the form and stood up and personally ushered the lady out the door. But, you know, that was kind of a neat little thing to read. You know, our society does not respect as much the career or the occupation of being a mother. And that's because we're materialistic. We respect money. We respect occupations that are paid well. And we respect people to the extent that they earn money. You know, I want to tell you that many young women feel pressure from other women, perhaps their own families, who say, in some way, you need to get out there and make something of yourself. You know, reach your potential. And as Christians, we need to resist the influence of our culture. We know that. The culture that says that earning potential is the best way to fulfill your potential, rather than bringing children into the world and making a home and raising children to fear God. Mary was pure, and she was engaged, and she was about the career that God had intended, and she was favored by God. But also, so I think she was favored because of her faith. In chapter 1 of Luke, let's go back there again, Luke chapter 1, verse 35 through 38, says, "And the angels answered and said to her," you know, this is after Mary had said, "How can this be? I'm a virgin." The angel answered and said to her, "The Holy Spirit is going to come upon you. The power of the Most High will overshadow you. And for that reason, the holy offspring shall be called the Son of God. And behold, even your relative Elizabeth has also conceived a son in her old age. And she who is called barren is now in her 6th month. For nothing will be impossible with God." And Mary said, "Behold, the bondservant of the Lord, be it done to me according to your word." And the angel departed from her. One time Jesus said that what God can do with us is according to our faith. And he said that to 2 blind men. He said, "According to your faith, may it be done to you," and he healed them. And he said that on three other occasions when he said, "Your faith has made you well." And then there was an occasion which we actually referred to earlier when he went to his own hometown, and it said he couldn't do any mighty works there, or very few mighty works, because of their unbelief. For Mary, she had to have faith of a virgin birth. She doesn't ask for a sign like Zechariah did. Zechariah had asked earlier in verse 18, he said, "How can I know this for certain, for I'm an old man?" I mean, he wanted to know. He wanted somebody to give him a sign. And Gabriel gave him a sign. He made him dumb until the baby was born. But she doesn't ask for a sign. She just wants to know how. Please help me understand how this happened. And so the angel explains to it that it's a miraculous conception. And her response, of course, is what we admire so much when she says, "Behold, the bondslave of the Lord, be it done to me according to your word." You know, I think bearing children, even under normal circumstances, is a great act of faith for a woman. It's an act of faith to trust in God to take the seed of life into your body and to carry it for 9 months. I mean, there is apprehension that goes with that every step of the way. There is personal sacrifice of things about yourself that you have to, in many ways, that goes on. But then you think about Mary and her faith that she would give birth without the normal process of conception. That her faith had to be based on the word of the angel, and because that certainly had never been done before from a Bible perspective. And yet, he said that with God, all things is possible. And he does give her a sign, though she doesn't ask for one. He says, "For even your relative Elizabeth has conceived a son in her old age, and she who is called barren is now in her 6 months." So he gives her a sign to help her understand that it is possible for God to do this, even with her in her condition. So she had great faith. But also I would suggest that she was favored by God because she was humble. I like the way that she expressed her faith. In verses 46 through 55, look at that passage. Luke chapter 1, verse 46 through 55. This is when she had gone to Elizabeth's house, her cousin or aunt who's in her sixth month. And she speaks by the word of the Lord. And in verse 46, she says, "My soul exalts the Lord, and my spirit has rejoiced in God my Savior. For he has had regard for the humble state of his bondslave. For behold, from this time on, all generations will count me blessed. For the Mighty One has done great things for me, and holy is his name. And his mercy is upon generation after generation toward those who fear him. He has done mighty deeds with his arm. He has scattered those who were proud in the thoughts of their heart. He has brought down rulers from their thrones and has exalted those who were humble. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent away the rich empty-handed. He has given health to Israel, his servant, in remembrance of his mercy. And as he spoke to our fathers, to Abraham and his offspring forever." An impressive Mary. She doesn't brag. She doesn't boast. You know, she could have said, "You know, I thought I was pretty good, but now I'm really sure of it." You know, that would not be a proper thing to do, would it, for a godly woman? It's not about how great I am, but it's about how great the Lord is and how undeserving I am. In fact, when she says in verse 48, you know, "For he has regarded the humble state of his bondslave," she's saying, "I'm nothing more than equal of a slave, and yet all women are going to count me as blessed." She can't believe what blessing she has been bestowed upon her. I think men ought not to boast either, though we seem to find a way to speak about our accomplishments at the drop of a hat. We ought to take the advice of the proverb writer who says, "Don't praise yourself, let someone else do it. Let the praise come from another and not from your own lips." Jesus said to the Pharisees, "Be aware that you have your reward in full," when they had their tendency to boast about all how godly they were and talk about their virtues. Now, I think it's a special virtue of a godly woman that this quality of humility. In 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 4, Peter makes a statement about the godly woman. He says, "But let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God." Here's the quality of character that God admires in her. And I think that would have been the character of Mary, the spirit of Mary, as she gives God the glory and thanks Him for this privilege that's been given her. There's no pride here. There's simply absolute amazement at the unimaginable opportunity to serve God in that capacity. And I think also she's favored because she was an obedient girl. Look over to Luke chapter 2 as we progress a little bit further. Luke chapter 2 tells us about the birth of her son in the first few verses. But by the time we get down to verse 22, it's 9 months later now, and the child's been born, and 33 days after the circumcision, Mary and Joseph would have made a trip to Jerusalem to present Jesus at the temple and to offer sacrifice for her purification, which was part of the law of Moses. Not purification because she was sinful because of this birth, but because it was a ritual uncleanness. And I want you to notice in chapter 2, verse 22, through I'm kind of skip around here for several verses to notice something that's repeated a number of times. Verse 22 says, when the days for her their purification according to the law of Moses were completed, they brought him up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. Then verse 23, as it is written in the law of the Lord, every firstborn male that opens the womb shall be called holy to the Lord. Verse 24 says, and to offer a sacrifice according to what was said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. Then down to verse 27, it came about it, and he came in the spirit into the temple. This is talking about a man named Simeon. And when the parents brought in the child Jesus to carry out for him the custom of the law, then he took him into his arms. And then if you drop down one more time in verse 39, just drop down to verse 39, it says, and when they had performed everything according to the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee to their own city of Nazareth. I think that you can see what's repeated every verse, that there was a law, and that this couple was conscientious to fulfill that law. It certainly couldn't have been convenient within a month of after she had given birth to make a trip from Nazareth in Galilee down to Jerusalem. And from what I've read, the Jews who lived in the Gentile cities such as Nazareth, because of the influence of the Gentiles, were not as meticulous in their observance of the laws of God as the Jerusalem Jews. But Mary was. And she went. Even though it would not have been convenient to travel, And she may have been able to rationalize why that was unnecessary, but she went there. And she's a model of a godly woman, I think, a woman who is going to obey the Lord above all things. I think these are some good possibilities for why she found favor with the Lord. But I want you to look a little bit further in her life, to a new stage. She now has another task on her hands. She's given birth. And she has the task of raising Jesus, a new part of her life that brings new challenges. And again, Mary is extraordinary, but she's also an ordinary woman as well. Mary was special, but like every other mother. And look back to Luke chapter 2, and I want to read with you verse 30 through 33. Luke chapter 2, verse 30 through 33. Now, when she brought her son to the temple, and Simeon took the child into his arms, he spoke of the Lord. He spoke in a prophetic way. And he says here, my eyes have seen thy salvation, which thou hast prepared in the presence of all peoples, a light of revelation to the Gentiles and the glory of thy people Israel. And his father and mother were amazed at the things which were being said about him. Tell you what there was for this mother, at least at that point, there is an anticipation of great things. I mean, what mother's heart would not swell with pride? My son is going to be the hope of salvation. He's going to be the revelation to the Gentiles. He is going to be he's going to be a great servant of the Lord. This is impressive. What a great anticipation to have of what your son's going to be. But then there comes the bad news, and Simeon isn't finished. And so he says in verse 34 and 35, and Simeon blessed them and said to Mary his mother, behold, this child is appointed for the fall and rise of many in Israel, and for a sign to be opposed. And a sword will pierce even your own soul, to the end that thoughts from many hearts may be revealed. Not only was there going to be anticipation of great things for her son, but there was also the certainty of dangers that lied ahead. This son would be a source of division, kind of a dual aspect of his coming. She would raise a son who would be opposed by others. And of course, you would find that out just within a couple of years when Herod began to pursue him, and she would have to flee into the night and take that child down to Egypt. So if you're Mary, how are you feeling right now? You're a mother. How would that affect you if you just heard this prophecy about your son? You know, most mothers dream of their sons growing up, having a good life, a good wife, being prosperous, being successful in business, and having little trouble as possible. And the last thing I think a mother, any mother, wants to hear is that there's trouble on the horizon that will come to him, that he's going to have a hard life, and that he's not going to be liked, that he's going to have enemies, that he's going to cause division. And like Simeon said, it's like a sword being driven through your soul. And I would imagine that that would be true for any mom as she saw those kind of things come to challenge her son. But again, we have the theme of the ordinary and the extraordinary. Mary has this extraordinary task of raising the Son of God, God's only begotten Son. And yet, at the same time, it's an ordinary thing. Every mother here tonight has been given the task of raising up children of God, sons and daughters for the Lord. To raise a servant of the Lord is to know that God will do great things with that person. He can do great things in his life. But it's also to know that persecutions will come. There's good news and bad news. He'll be a blessing to others, but there's a certainty of hardships if he is truly faithful. It's another aspect, I think, of a godly woman. The faith of a godly woman. In the midst of uncertainty, she's going to have to carry on in faith and in hope. But I want to suggest there's another thing that Mary had to deal with, as well as mothers in any time period. There's the worries as independence comes with their children. The worry is, as Mary dealt with it in Luke chapter 2, verse 41, Mary and Joseph, some 12 years later, would make a trip to Jerusalem for the Passover. That would have been something that would be normal for them. They would do that every year. But this time it would be a little bit different, because after that they were there for a while and they started their trip back home, they found out Jesus was gone. And so verse 41 says his parents used to go to Jerusalem every year at the Feast of the Passover. And when he became 12, they went up there according to the custom of the feast. And as they were returning, after spending a full number of days, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, and his parents were unaware of it. But they supposed him to be in the caravan and went a day's journey, and they began looking for him among their relatives and acquaintances. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem looking for him. And it came about that after 3 days, they found him. Can you imagine 3 days? I mean, Monica gets worried if I leave the kids out in the front yard unattended for a few minutes. And rightly so, you know. But, you know, it's every mother's nightmare that their child's going to get lost or separated from them, or even worse, get accosted and taken away. I can't even imagine Mary's terror as she's contemplating this idea that Jesus is gone. We've lost the Messiah, you know. But she does find him. They find him. And you kind of see this mother's affectionate love. You see her in chapter 2 and verse 48 when she does encounter him. And she saw him and they're astonished. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us this way? Behold, your father and I have been anxiously looking for you." I mean, she's chiding him some. She was worried about him like a mother would be. But look at where he is. Look at where he is. Verse 46. You know, he's in the temple. He's sitting in the midst of the teachers. And he's listening to them. And he's discussing things. He's asking questions of them. And they're amazed at his understanding and his answers. And then, of course, as she responds to his response to her is, "Why is it that you were looking for me? Didn't you know that I had to be in my father's house?" And he's not talking about Joseph now. He's making the connection. So even at age 12, you know, he's becoming more independent of his family. He's sensing his spiritual priorities. He's already has a sense of who he is. And then Mary reflects on that. Mary's reflections are there in verse 51 and 52. You know, he went down with them and came to Nazareth. He continued in subjection to them. And his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature and in the favor of God and with men. So she watches him grow. She sees him developing. She doesn't understand all of this, but she's treasuring these things in her heart. And she's watching him. And Mary doesn't understand all of these things. She's learning from misunderstanding some about how God is going to use her son in his plan. This is a godly woman who's trying to fathom the plan of God as it would be worked out in her son's life. And that kind of takes us back to the incident in John chapter 11 in Cana of Galilee when they were at the wedding feast. And or John chapter 2, and Jesus is not a boy of 12 now. When you get there, he's 30. He's 30 years old. He was baptized. We have that account in John chapter 1. He's now a boy of 30 years old. They're at this wedding feast, and the wine is gone, and the mother sees that, and she says, they don't have any wine. She has some kind of expectation of him here. She kind of expects him to, it's time for him to do something. She's watched him over 30 years grow up. He's been baptized. Now he has disciples who are following him. And, maybe every mother wants to see her child get on with their potential. And who knows? Maybe she's getting a little bit pushy here. But, every mother can relate to this. Mary is exceptional, but she's ordinary too. Mothers want their sons to succeed. And it's not unusual for a mother to want this to happen. She's trying to prepare the way for him. She goes to the servant. She says, you do whatever he tells you to. She's going to use her influence to help support his work. That's Mary being a mother, wanting to help her son and use her influence to help him, even though she didn't understand. And he gently tells her, He says, "Woman, what do I have to do with this? What is this to me? This is not my time. This is not what this is about." And then one other incident where that same thing sort of occurs again, Mark chapter 3 and verse 20 and 21. It's a time when Jesus is growing in his popularity, and he's being surrounded by the multitudes to such an extent he can't even get time. He can't even get time to eat a meal. And it says, when his own people heard of this, this is verse 21 of Mark chapter 3, they went out to take custody of him, for they were saying, he has lost his senses, he's gone crazy. And they see the Pharisees and the religious leaders, and they're threatening him, they're trying to discredit him. And it seems to me that they see danger ahead, and they're trying to stop the snowballing effect here. And we know that Mary was there. We know that she was there because a little bit later, after he sort of tells another little story, it says his mother and his brothers arrived in verse 31, and he's telling what happened. And they were standing outside, and they're sending word. They're trying to get him out of there, get him out of the midst. And they say, "Behold," one of the people say, "Behold, your mother and your brothers are outside looking for you." And he says, "Who is my mother and my brothers?" And looking about on those who are sitting around him, he said, "Behold, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother." So here you have a concerned mother, misguided, yes, but it's a mother's love here too. And she would have probably felt the rebuke as that word kind of trickled back to her of what he said in the midst of those people, and denies his family in a sense to embrace his disciples. But that doesn't discourage her. Doesn't discourage her. Godly women grow as they see how God will work out his plan in their children. And so she's going to be up here another time, two more times, and then we're going to stop. Let's stay with me. Let's look a little bit further to the end, John chapter 19. Mary is a constant. She's there even at the cross when everything looks hopeless. John chapter 19, verse 25 through 27. Most disciples have fled. They've left him there alone, but she's there along with just a few others. It says the other disciples, chapter 19, verse 25 through 27. Therefore the soldiers did these things, but there were standing by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. And when Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." And he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour the disciple took her into his own household. You know, here she is, and she's there, and there's nothing she can do. She has no power to help him. There's no medicine she can give him. She has no political power to change the course of this situation. There's nothing that she can give. But he sees her, and of course she's a widow now. She's not a caretaker, but she's someone who needs to be cared for. And he provides for her. But she is where we would expect a godly woman to be when her children are in trouble. Her son is ridiculed and he's slandered, and she is there. And it's not unusual to find a godly mother standing close by godly children, even when she can't do anything. She's there in faith and hope that God would work this out for good in his own way. And then if you look at one last place in Acts chapter 1, it's almost a passing remark. You almost don't even catch it. But she appears one last time. And this is when the disciples are gathered, and Jesus has left, and they're in the upper room, and they're waiting for the day of Pentecost. And it says in verse 14, "These all with one mind were continually devoting themselves to prayer, along with the women, and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and his brothers were there." You know, Mary's salvation was dependent on the same basis as our salvation. She's among the disciples. You know, a woman gets credit for bearing children, for making a home, but that is not enough. Not even enough for Mary, even when she raised the Son of God herself. He said to her, he said what we read earlier, "Who is my mother? It's those who do the will of my Father who is in heaven." And so here she is, and she's among the disciples of Jesus. And there was a woman in Luke chapter 11 who one time said to Jesus, one of the women in the crowd raised her voice and said to him, "Blessed is the womb that bore you and the breast at which you nursed." And Jesus said, "On the contrary, blessed are those who hear the word of God and those who observe it." And so Mary was faithful as a mother, but she was faithful even more as a disciple of her son. She was faithful as all of us have to be faithful. You know, I suspect that when the gospel was preached on the day of Pentecost, that she would have been one of the 3,000. And in a minute, we're going to invite you to become a Christian, just like Mary would have become a Christian, like all of those other disciples being baptized. But I want to make one final comment, as again an application to young ladies and to young men, that when you look for a model for a woman who is favored by God, you need to look at Mary. And so many today are looking at Britney Spears and so many other highly glamorized and popular young stars. You would not find Mary among them. She won't be on American Idol. She won't be listed among the dance queens and the singers. Here's a woman that God favored. She would not catch the eye of the American public. She would not be featured in Teen Magazine. She wouldn't have an appearance there. We don't honor that kind of girl in our society. And yet she was highly favored by God. She is a model to be imitated by women who aspire to godliness. And I'd caution older women, you be careful what you influence the younger girls to model themselves after. They are impressionable. And they hear everything we say, what we're impressed with, what makes a woman important and attractive. And it is not a shame to be common and ordinary and poor and simple. And Mary was highly favored above all the women in her day. And God chose her. He didn't look in Jerusalem. He didn't go search among the leading ladies and the best bred and the best etiquette and the well-paid professionals. It was not the criteria God was interested in. He found his choice in a young girl, a nobody, in a nowhere town because of the kind of person that she was. And for the young man who wants to know what a godly woman is, and you haven't married and you're wondering what kind of woman does God favor, Mary serves as a model of a godly woman. And so we need to be careful, mothers, about who you allow to influence your sons and shape their dreams of a woman and a wife and a mother. Is it a woman like Mary? Mary would invite us to follow her son and become his disciple as well, believing on him. Would you do that tonight? Would you be a disciple like Mary was of her own son, as together we stand and we sing our song?